Welcome to episode 18 of All the Small Takes. I'm here with John and Cooper on this Tuesday night. And the NBA season's officially over. The Cavs are officially done. Cooper, how are you coping?
I'm doing okay. I managed my expectations well. I'm doing fine. It's the magic of expectations.
The first phase is denial.
we'll help you through this, buddy.
Yeah, that's what we're here for. John, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine. My team was out of this in January? February?
November?
Not February.
November?
No,
wait.
We were competing in February. Yeah, whenever the All-Star break was, it was around then.
I can remember a podcast back in like April when you were talking like playoff probabilities. There's like you were doing mathematical calculations.
Oh yeah, we weren't mathematically eliminated yet at that point. Yeah. You're right. So,
hey, there's always next year, right?
Trust the process.
Trust the process. Raise the cat. In Hinky we trust. All right.
So many.
We're going to talk about next year actually on this podcast. We're going to talk about what went wrong for the Cavs and then maybe. Also, what they can do in the offseason to get back. But first, you can find us on social media, Twitter at Small Takes, Instagram small_takes, Facebook All the Small Takes, and Gmail allthesmalltakes@gmail.com. Subscribe on iTunes, leave that review. Have we had a review lately? I haven't checked.
Sure hope not. It'll just be a bad week.
It's almost like the incentive we
this
gave
would be
people.
The week to do it, actually, probably.
Yeah, it's almost like the incentive we gave people is actually a disincentive.
Yeah, maybe we should flip that. Maybe we release the video and then promise to take it down once we get that number of reviews.
We basically hold people hostage, hold our listeners hostage. That sounds like a good idea. All right, let's talk about the NBA Finals. And we'll start with what went wrong for the Cavaliers, because there's a number of things I think you can look back on and maybe point to. I know, Cooper, you've got a few. John, as the objective voice of reason, maybe we'll start with you. What did you think the Cavs did that let this series kind of slip away from them?
Okay, well, I think to start with, I don't quite agree with the way you phrased the question. I don't think the focus should be quite as much on the Cavs in this series. I think the focus belongs with Golden State. What I mean by that is that it's not necessarily anything the Cavs did wrong. The Cavs played like a very good NBA team and the best NBA team in an average season. The problem was they played the best NBA team in NBA history, in the Golden State Warriors. And something that makes the Golden State Warriors so great is something the Cavs don't do that much, and most NBA teams don't do really at all, and that's play defense. Down the stretch, what really hurt the Cavs a lot was the fact that the Warriors actually would come back and they would actually play defense at the end of game five. So I don't, you can be sad if you're a Cavs fan, you can be excited if you're a Golden State Warriors fan. I think the reality is that this iteration of the Golden State Warriors is maybe the best team that has ever played in NBA history. And when you're playing the best team in NBA history, you're not going to win 4 out of 7 games. So,
yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think if you take Durant off this team and put Harrison Barnes back on it, and played the series this year, I mean, I don't even think that it makes it to 7. I think the Cavs would probably win that series in, 5 or 6. But I think that's kind of the difference that Durant made in this series. So kind of agree with John. But that being said, I think game 3 was pivotal. I think that's kind of where it fell apart for the Cavs. They really should have won that game. If they would have shot anything decent from beyond the arc, they probably would have. Top of my head, I think Kevin Love went like, 1 for 9? From 3-point range or something like that. So I think that's kind of where it went wrong. I think in a way this looked like an NBA series that almost like ended a little bit too early. Like there were lots of adjustments. I think in a way the Cavs figured out that they needed to play physical, but the problem is they didn't have game 6 to fall back on because they lost game 3. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of where it went wrong for the Cavs, just game 3.
But isn't there something to the fact that even for however many shots they missed in game 3, like they were up 6 with 3 minutes to go and the Warriors ended the game on 11-0 run. Like they were very much in a position to win that game, even though they didn't have their best shooting night.
Yeah, I'm saying, I mean, I don't even think it should have been a 6-1 game. I think the Cavs probably should have put that one to bed a lot earlier. Okay. Yes, I mean, they had a fourth quarter meltdown, but at the same time, Kyrie and LeBron were exhausted. I mean, Kyrie had to he still put up 40 points that game, right? No, 38 points that game. Sorry. Without, like, I don't think he made a single three. So Kyrie had to work a lot more because he didn't have his range going. So, you know, Clay, he wasn't making Clay honor his range. And so I think both Clay and, I mean, Kyrie and LeBron had to work more for their shots. They were exhausted. They were dead.
Yeah, and if Kevin Durant misses one shot down the stretch there, the Cavs win the game.
Yeah.
And I think again, that gets back to the idea that I don't think the Cavs necessarily did anything wrong for an NBA team. I don't, like, their defense, it's not an all-world defense, but no one in the NBA plays all-world defense. That's the reality of the game. It wasn't bad for an NBA team. They were playing the best team that we've ever seen. And Kevin Durant down the stretch in game three, that's what it was.
Yeah, I think there's some, like, mini other storylines, like little mini tiny ones. And in a way, I think I was right. I think the Cavs need to learn that they need to play with almost like a selective pace, not gunning it all the time because that leads to turnovers like it did in game one. But you need to make the Warriors play at pace offensively because they turn over the ball a lot. It's really like the one weakness in their armor. And they really need to, I think, play more physically. They realized that in game four and five, and it worked for them. I just wish they wouldn't have been so timid in games one and two.
The one storyline that I think the other mini storyline that didn't get nearly as much coverage as I thought it should have is from game five. Kyrie Irving was playing with not one but two, and if he's healthy, if he's even 90%, because he had a back injury and he was battling a knee injury as well. If he's remotely healthy, I think the Cavs have a very good chance of winning that game last night because...
Yeah, but I mean, Warriors fans are saying the same, you know, same thing about last year. Sure. Well, Steph's healthy.
Yeah,
then
no, injuries are part of the game, of course. Yeah. But
how much did Kyrie score last night?
He had 26 last night.
Yeah,
but it was through like three quarters. He like barely scored at all in the fourth
quarter.
Crazy.
Like, it felt like the bar that he set, and like even in those games where they got blown out, like you said, Cooper, when he scored 38 in a loss, like... That's the bar that he set for himself. And when he's playing at that level, like, I thought him even close to that level last night could have pushed him over the edge. And I know you're right about injuries. Like, it goes both ways, but I thought that was an understated part of last night's game. Anything else about the game? Nope. Outside we want to talk. Let's look forward. Let's be optimistic if we can. Cooper, what do you think?
I'm up first.
Yeah. Because I know you are the voice of optimism, surprisingly.
I know. So,
I
think
they need to do in the offseason.
I mean, there's very little the Cavs can't do, right? They're extremely handicapped by their cap position. So, they didn't really leave themselves with much room and flexibility. I think my dream scenario would be to eliminate kind of this big three mentality. I think the Cavs showed in this series that their advantage is they had the best duo, per se. Like, Kyrie and LeBron are better than Steph and Durant. And so I think they need to...
Is that the ghost?
Is that ghost? Yeah, no, it's a ghost.
The ghost of the Stanley Cup is revisiting us?
Oh, wow.
Everything's fine.
You did an exorcism?
No, I don't. No, I don't. Got the crucifix in the back right there.
All right, back to what I was saying. don't even remember where I was on. Oh, the whole dynamic duo thing. So I think in a way, like, Kevin Love kind of actually can, like, hurt them a little bit because you have to give Kevin Love his touches and you have to kind of work him into the game plan when I almost don't think it's necessary. So I would like to see the Cavs almost somehow find a way to dump Kevin Love's cap and just build kind of a better supporting cast. And I think there are, like, free agents out there that would be attainable for the Cavs. Obviously, you can't get all of these, but I think Kentavious Caldwell-Pope would be huge for the Cavs. Jeff Teague to back up Kyrie. I'd like to see Wade and LeBron play together. And then the Cavs need someone to support Tristan down low. And I think Nerlens Noel would be perfect coming off the bench, anchoring the defense, or even Dwayne Dedman from the Spurs. So that's the dream. It's not going to happen.
That's the wish list, though.
Wish list.
John, a friend of yours popped up on that list. An old friend.
Yeah, an old friend. An old friend. He might be back before too long.
That was the ghost of Nerlens.
I think that was, yeah.
Do you have thoughts on what the Cavs need to do this offseason?
I do. I think much like the United States in the 1950s, the Cavaliers stand at a pivotal point in history where they're engaged in an arms race with another superpower, the only superpower remaining after Oklahoma City has been dismantled and Boston has whatever they're going to do, you know, if they're going to decide to play for now or bank their picks and just wait for whenever these super teams fall.
Gordon Hayward. Forget about San Antonio moving to a retirement community.
Yeah, moving to a retirement community. And then we also have the process coming up on the horizon. So, you know, I don't know. The metaphor gets a bit stretched, but the reality remains that they're engaged in a Cold War arms race with the Golden State Warriors, and they need more firepower. They need more weapons. And I don't think players is the way to go. I think what you need is another LeBron. And you know, there's only one, but the closest thing I think that you can get to another player like LeBron James in the NBA is Paul George. So I think Indy is staring at the brink because Paul George is getting ready to just take a jump and leave them and go to LA, and they're going to have to hit the hard reset and rebuild. But if they were to take Kevin Love straight up for Paul George from the Cavs, they could let Love come out and get more minutes, turn back kind of back into the player he was his last year in Minnesota, where he was a huge, you know, he was an all-star, had double-digit scoring, double-digit rebounds. I mean, you can build around that. They've got a lot of young players that could develop with more time on the court that Paul George wouldn't be taking up. And I think there's a lot to be said for that trade. And Paul George, they get their third guy who can be on the court the whole time and who can create as much space and all the matchup problems that LeBron does with the Warriors as they are.
And importantly, who can defend a guy like Kevin Durant?
Yeah, he can.
Yeah.
This is the, you know, the Reagan-esque moment where the Cavs can either stand up and say, we're going to win, or they can ride off into the sunset.
Mr. And let the Warriors tear down that wall.
Yeah, I actually like it. I think it's actually fairly realistic. And I think I gave my dream scenario, and I don't want to cut Jeff completely from this conversation. But I do want to say, I think, like Paul George, I like DeMarcus Cousins a lot. And I think the Pelicans are more willing and likely to deal him for Love than the Pacers are to deal Paul George for Love, mainly because DeMarcus Cousins comes with his attitude problems. And perhaps more importantly, Kevin Love fits into that offense that New Orleans is trying to run better than DeMarcus Cousins does. And I think DeMarcus Cousins would be huge for the Cavs because he plays good interior defense, which is something the Cavs don't really currently do. He would be another interior rebounder, which I thought Tristan Thompson had sealed up, but did not really do too well in this series. And also, I mean, he's a great offensive player. So I would like, I think that's my realistic scenario.
And if there's ever a situation that would be good for a guy like Boogie who has a questionable character, like past, I guess, however you want to put it, it's on a team with LeBron.
Yes.
It's almost like that with the Patriots. Not to see you let me into the conversation, and this is what happens. It's almost like what the Patriots do with like what Randy Moss and Corey Dillon and like these guys who have off the field issues in the past, and they come in. And it's like I think LeBron has established a system and a discipline and a culture that that would fit well with Boogie. The one thing I'll just add, kind of related, I think Kevin Love, like I agree with what John said actually, that I think he could. People forget how good he was in Minnesota as the number one guy. And I actually gained a ton of respect for him in particularly this series because he was not a focal point on the offensive end, obviously, and he was getting banged around and really doing a lot of the dirty work on defense. I don't know. I liked the way he battled when it clearly wasn't an ideal situation for him in terms of his offensive game. And it showed me a lot because that was one of the things that people said about him in Minnesota was that he chased stats and he chased rebounds and he didn't necessarily have the competitive streak. And I thought he showed that in this series. So if I'm a team like the Pacers or like the Pelicans who could make him at least the two guy, if not the one guy on your team, I would be ready to ride with Kevin Love. Mm-hmm.
But quick question. Does this mean that you are also on the cutting Kevin Love from the Cavs. Like, because you're saying Kevin Love's this good player, but you're also saying that maybe he's only a good player for the Pelicans and the Pacers.
Yeah, I think at this point, I think he needs a new situation. I think the Cavs need a fresh start, and I think they need an upgrade at that position, mm-hmm. or at least an upgrade at other positions that he could give you, like a Paul George, or at least free up the cap space to maybe sign one of those free agents that you talked about. Gordon Hayward to the Celtics. That's the other part that I wanted to add to the conversation.
Gosh.
Put it in stone. Actually, shouldn't have said that. All right, let's let's talk about U.S. soccer. Cooper.
What's our time limit on the soccer conversation?
However long we want it to be. I think
all day.
You have the reins on this because you and John, I think, but before we came on, you were boasting about how you basically nailed the predictions for their...
Well, I mean, John predicted 3 points in Mexico City.
True, that's
which
true.
Has happened one time in the history of American soccer. So, and it did not repeat itself on Sunday night. So, yeah, no, I did kind of... I mean, I aced U.S. soccer World Cup qualifiers. Yeah, I think the week was good for them. They got exactly what I wanted them to get. The Trinidad and Tobago match obviously was a prelude to the Mexico game. You could tell the U.S. players were amped about Mexico. Really, you know, couldn't care less about Trinidad and Tobago, which sounds bad, but they were just looking forward to the Mexico game. It wasn't their best showing, but they got the win, which was necessary. And I liked what I saw against Mexico. I thought we were, you know, we're at a disadvantage from a technical standpoint, from a personnel standpoint when we play Mexico. We're at an extreme disadvantage. We're an extreme disadvantage when it comes to the environment of playing in Azteca. It's 7,800, feet and all those things. That, you know, it's one of the biggest soccer stadiums in the world. And I think they held their own. I was pretty pumped.
Yeah, no, I loved it. I love me some Michael Bradley. And that was an amazing shot from Captain America to start the game off. It was very Carly Lloyd-esque. Mm. And whenever the men's team can do more things like the women's team, I think we're going to win more. And I mean, that was great. But then with Trinidad and Tobago, it was kind of like a game where the team was in a funk the whole first half. And then Christian Pulisic was able to rip off two goals there. And it's great that we have a player who can come in and fill that role for the U.S. because it hasn't always been there. We've spent those games just wandering through the doldrums and ending up with a draw or a goal in the 91st minute. And just escaping.
Yeah, it wasn't a pretty win, but got the 3 points.
No, but so, yeah, he pulled us through with the 3 points. So
yeah, so that gets to a good question that we wanted to get your thoughts on, both of you. Is the hype real with Christian Pulisic? Is he, because I feel like in our lifetime, there's been like five separate faces of U.S. soccer, like the next face of U.S. soccer. And he's the latest, but it seems like it's a little more real. Is that your guys' opinion, or do you think he still has something to prove?
I mean, he still has something to prove because he's not a full-time starter at a top-tier club. So it seems a little silly to call him like an international talent or an international success. But I wouldn't mind saying that he is the most talented person on the USA team right now. I think that is fine. And I think he's maybe close to the most talented player in CONCACAF.
I think the hype is real, but that doesn't mean we still don't need to cool down a little bit. I think he's probably the greatest American soccer player to ever play.
Yeah.
As you say, we need to cool down the hype.
I know. I'm not cooling it down. But like John said, at the same time, he's not like he wouldn't be considered a world-class player by many other standards. He's not a guaranteed starter for Dortmund yet. And he showed his age and his inexperience in the Mexico game where he had pretty much vanished for the whole entire 89 minutes, I think. Well, he played. He got subbed off.
He also wasn't being played in his true position there. He was being played in the wing where he's a lot.
No, that is actually his true position.
No, his real position
is for Dortmund, John. It's where he has the most experience.
I know.
Outside on the wings.
No.
So if anything, he should have looked better on the wings where he had the opportunity to exploit Mexico's defense in a counterattacking scenario than as a center attacking mid, where he probably would have gotten like just blitzed by two of the strong point of Mexico's team, which is really their two holding midfielders. They're one of two, like, that's rare for two teams to play with two holding midfielders. Pulisic would have really struggled there. I was disappointed by his performance in the Mexico game.
I think that a quality that Pulisic has with his game is that ghostly ability to slip past defenders and just have people lose track of him. And that's something that's much harder to do when you're on the wing, where you can only move one direction as opposed to the middle, where you get more of the field to manipulate and to use.
I mean, the best players in the world play that position in Ronaldo and Messi, and it's not an excuse. If you're going to be, which, I mean, I'm really sure, like, I hope he is one day a top five player in the world. He, like, regardless of where you play, that's where the team needed you, and he did not perform.
Well, yeah, he's also 18, and that's what I'm saying is that he would have played a better game as an 18-year-old in the middle of the field, I think, because that is his natural talent spot. But, I mean, I agree with Cooper. I think he's the greatest American soccer player to lace up the boots and play the game. And I'd be willing to bet that by the time we get to, Russia 2018, that he's going to be the guy. And Clint Dempsey's going to feel lucky that he's, you know, still remembered, because he's going to be so far removed from being captain and so far removed from being the guy for Team USA. But I think additionally, something else to say, though, is that on the international level, there are people close to his age that that teams and development programs are way more excited about, like Kylian Mbappe or whatever from Monaco. And gosh,
Rashford from Manchester
United. Yeah.
So,
and Dele Alli too. He's a little bit older, but I mean, he hasn't broken through yet. And when the European teams start, once a European team pays him, I think it is safe to say that he will have arrived on the international stage, and he will at least be an international talent. And then from there, we'll be able to safely kind of evaluate how good he is.
Mm-hmm. If Alexi Lalas is listening, disregard the comment about the greatest American soccer player of all time. That's still you, Alexi.
Oh, I know. I think Alexi occupies a much better spot in American soccer, where he has become the face of American soccer. So you don't have to be the best player of all time to be the face of American soccer. I mean, Jerry West is the face of the NBA, mm-hmm. and he's not the great. No one talks about him as the greatest NBA player of all time.
Good save, John. Good save.
Yeah, we love you, Alexi.
We had another quick question on the U.S. soccer topic of U.S. soccer. Bruce Arenas has come into the fold, obviously, and they've turned things around a bit from their struggles early on in qualifying. I, as an outsider, the perception of Bruce Arenas seems to be that it's not so much the tactics that he brings as much as it is he's more of a player's coach, to borrow a term from other sports. It seems like he's kind of a motivator and a rallier of the team, more so than like a tactical guru. But I'm interested in your guys, as more knowledgeable soccer fans than I, on your thoughts.
Kind of played himself as a tactical genius, or at least tried to. I mean, he made 7 changes in between the games against Trinidad and Tobago and Mexico in an 11-man lineup, which is, I mean, that's rarely do you see that really happen. It was a 3-day, 4-day span. No, I don't think it's really hard to be that much tactically superior to Jurgen Klinsmann, who is kind of a tactical idiot at points. I think he made a couple of mistakes. I think in Trinidad and Tobago, our outside midfielders were switched. He wanted to get more crosses in instead of having them cut in, which I think seemed to be an advantage. And I did not – that goal, I'm still very disappointed in. That goal we gave up to Mexico, it was bad. You really can't give up a counterattack that starts with the goalie's hand. And I think Kellen Acosta, who I think for the most part played a pretty good game alongside Bradley, kind of showed his lack of experience on that big of a stage. He should have fouled Chicharito and didn't, and just kind of let him dance around him. And it would have been a yellow card. It would have been a foul at midfield, but it would have stopped the break. So I think that was one personnel change that I didn't really agree with. But overall, I think very positive for U.S. soccer.
Yeah, I'm a little wary about sort of coronating Arenas as the like savior of American soccer, I think that there's a lot to be said for making a change, period, leading to good things. I mean, Jurgen first came in, there's a lot of energy, and the team won some big games when he first took over. I think the same can be expected when you switch over to another competent soccer mind in Bruce Arenas. But I do think, but there's like a big difference. Like, for instance, Jurgen Klinsmann sometimes would tell his players the day before, the day of the game, what their formation was going to look like and where they were going to play on the field. Arenas told his back line that they were going to be playing with a three-man back line or whatever the base back line for the Mexico game 2 weeks in advance and time to sort of mentally prepare themselves. And so I think, I don't know if he's that much of an advantage in game, but it's the out of game, it's the 5 minutes before, the day before, the 3 days before where I think Arenas is good, where he can, that, you know, players coach mindset, he can at least head and get them to calm down and focus on the task at hand. It was something Jurgen ever was able to get a handle on.
All right, let's move on then to our one segment for the week, besides the waste of data, which we'll get to. We're going to do another mock draft. This is the mock draft segment. You've heard us do a couple mock drafts. This is the mock draft 2020.1. Let's go with that, because it is the mock draft for the Olympic, the U.S. Olympic 3-on-3 basketball team. They announced this week that 3-on-3 basketball is going to be an Olympic sport, which is amazing. NBA Street come to life.
But goaltending is still not legal.
Goaltending is still not legal. You still get your game. Maybe, well, they haven't announced the full rules yet.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we're going to do a dream mock draft. So the reality of the situation is a lot of these guys who will probably name off here won't play on this 3-on-3 team because they play either for the actual men's national team or they will just choose not to play. But we thought it'd be fun little exercise to pick our teams. We're going to do a draft style. None of us know what the others are going to pick. We are going in this completely blind. So adjusting on the fly, seat of our pants. We're doing the draft. We determined in the order of members of this podcast who've gotten married, who are getting married. So Cooper,
marriage, the order
marriage.
Of marriage,
yeah, the order of marriage,
order of all marriage.
Right. So this will be a huge surprise, I think. All right, I'm gonna take Steph number one. I think in a 3-on-3 league, I mean, Steph is the greatest like 3-point shooter we've probably ever seen, and I think in a 3-on-3 league, spacing is so key. And so there's no one in the world that can space the court like Steph. And I'm going to set up an offense where Steph is just running, just gassing himself on the baseline.
And you're not going to have him handling the ball?
No, because
he's got like the best handle in NBA history.
I have ideas. Steph, pick one.
All right. Also, I just want to correct you. They'd be two-pointers.
They'd be two-pointers? Oh, thank you. Yeah.
For plays, free rules. All right. Okay. Does this mean I'm next?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, yeah, it does mean you're next. No need to rub it in.
Spoiler. In 4 days, I am getting married. So the next time you hear this podcast, I won't be a part of it. You're welcome. this is tough. I thought I knew who I wanted to take, and then Cooper kind of surprised me because I really was like 99.9% sure you were going to take LeBron. I think I want Russ Westbrook. I think I want Russ. I think in a 3-on-3 game, you want someone who can create more so than facilitate, given the spacing and just the nature of the game, and his ability to get to the rim and just his like downhill attacking style, I think fits well. So Russ is my number one. John.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to take LeBron James. Because I don't know what world you guys are living in, but I mean, I know the Olympics are 2 years away, three. I don't know how many years away they are. 4 years or whatever. Who cares? LeBron James is the best basketball player in the world. And LeBron James can shoot threes. He can shoot twos or whatever they are. He can make free throws. He can back people down in the paint. He can handle the ball. He can facilitate. I don't know what more you want from a basketball player. So if I'm building a 3-on-3 team, I'm getting LeBron.
John, you bring up a good point. Is this the rules of this game have yet to been fleshed out, I think. Is this going to be call your own fouls? Is this
going to
be, are there free throws? Is this just like check it up?
LeBron's the guy who would call a foul every single play.
I've said that on the podcast before.
No.
Like, that's a hand check.
Actually, I can see him do it. Yeah.
Don't reach. Don't reach, young blood. All right. So we snake it. John, you're next. You get back-to-back picks.
Oh, okay. All right. I get back-to-back picks. All right. I'm going to take Kyrie Irving. Because apparently he's not Australian, as I was led to believe.
Dual citizenship.
Dual citizenship. He played for Team USA, so he's locked in for us. So I'm just going to double down on that for the 3-on-3 in case there are different rules there. So we'll go ahead and take Kyrie just in case. He's really good and he plays really well with LeBron.
I'm going to continue on the theme that we've got going on here of teammates. We're going to do a reunion. We're going to mend some bridges. And we're going to bring Kevin Durant to my team to play with Russell Westbrook.
You think Russ is just gonna like throw the ball at Kevin Durant the whole game, never pass it to him? KD's
I think they'll put their differences aside to dominate in a situation that they've probably dreamed of, where they don't have Andre Roberson on the court with them and have to like pass the ball to Steven Adams every once in a while. So yeah, Kevin Durant, Cooper, who do you got next?
You guys made this so hard. Initially wanted to pick James Harden, but. Ooh. James Harden's defense is atrocious, and I can't have James Harden and Steph Curry play on the same team because then I wouldn't be able to defend anyone.
You'd be a little outsized.
Yeah,
I would. Oh, but I want him so bad. Okay, anyways. All right, I'll go with Paul George as my second pick. I guess because he gives me the defensive edge, he can still stretch the floor. He's a poor man's LeBron, so I'll take Paul George.
And then you get the follow-up pick, too.
I know. I love this part of the draft. I'll take Anthony Davis as my last pick.
Ooh.
Yeah, because I'm just going to rely on stretching the court. Anthony Davis will dominate the inside for me.
I'm just looking at your team. I'm thinking about who I – because I'm imagining these as teams against each other, which doesn't make any sense. But
Well, no, they would have to play against each other to then, like, you know, qualify for being the USA's team.
They had to play in the Hex to qualify.
In the Hex, exactly. In the Hex, of course.
A Hex with three teams.
To try.
You passed geometry. You okay. Will.
Yes, I did. Who do I want here? Man. See, I feel like KD fills my big man quota.
So in this scenario, you're putting Kevin Durant.
Kawhi Leonard. Ooh, I'm taking Kawhi Leonard, defensive stalwart. I love that team. Russ, KD, Kawhi.
All right, I got to think about this last one. It's got LeBron, and I got Kyrie.
Kevin Love, perfect.
No.
JR.
Shoots from anywhere.
Yeah, I'm just going to.
Devin Booker.
Go ahead and take Chris Paul.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, someone could have done like a banana boat crew.
I know, that's what I was thinking about. But I
could have done like LeBron, Melo, and CP3.
Carmelo doesn't belong in this.
John, who's going to run point, man?
LeBron.
So you're really stacking the rest of the court with some size. Clearly.
Yeah, we're spacing.
I want to know what – I want like people to tell us who they think would win.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, that's a great idea. So let's run it back real quick. We've got Jeff's team, which is Russ Westbrook, KD, and Kawhi Leonard. Cooper has Steph, Paul George, and Anthony Davis. John has LeBron, Kyrie Irving, and Chris Paul. Which team do you guys think would win the Hex and qualify for the Olympics? Man, there's some like glaring omissions here. Like Melo's one, Harden is one, but I guess like you have to adjust to the style of playing a 3-on-3.
Karl-Anthony Towns is a big one. Boogie,
Nerlens Noel, and Jahlil Okafor. Okay.
Clay.
So
Isaiah
anyway,
Thomas.
That was a more fun exercise than I thought it was going to be. John Wall. Oh, my God.
How did we leave John Wall and Isaiah Thomas off?
Well, Isaiah Thomas can't play
Isaiah
defense.
Like in a 3-on-3 scenario. It's 3-on-3. Why do you need to play defense?
Dude,
if you can take on three guys and score every time, why do you need to play defense?
No, you still need defense. You need defense more. That's why I liked Kawhi. So anyway, we don't want to get too caught up in this, but if you guys have thoughts on maybe toss out your teams, your dream teams for the mock draft for the 2020 Olympics 3-on-3 tournament. Let's move on now to our last segment, though, the waste of data, what we end every episode with. And we'll start with, John wants to go last. Little annotation here in the Google Docs. We'll start with Cooper.
All right, sweet. Just give me the, I'll go first and probably talk the longest. I've been waiting a really long time on this podcast to kind of talk about my affinity or lack thereof for Draymond Green. And I do want to start out by, I think Draymond is a very unique and special player in the NBA in the sense that he knows what he does well and he excels at it and he doesn't try and be anything he's not. But at the same time, I'm calling him out finally. It's kind of overdue for, I guess, coming out and saying that Cleveland fans aren't necessarily the sharpest for their behavior in games 3 and 4. And first, I want to point out that it seemed to work in game 4. So I think it almost was kind of sharp because Draymond had his worst game in the series in game 4. He basically talked his way out of the game. He was so mentally out of that game because he was so aggravated and annoyed by what was going on that he didn't play. Also, at the same time, he doesn't really seem to be the sharpest player ever in the sense that he said later in that same interview that Tex will not force him to play a certain way. But the thing is, buddy, that Tex can force you to play a certain way in the sense that they can take you off the court.
They should have taken him off the court.
And they should have taken him off the court in game 4. And this comes a year removed from last year's final series when he lost that series for his team because of his antics on the court. And lastly, I think Draymond just needs to get his act together. He really looks, he makes Reggie Miller look like a saint, I think, which is saying something. He really could and probably should get a tech after every single play where a whistle's blown. He talks to the refs and yells at them and yells at other players probably more than any other player we've ever seen. I think God has put him in a very special position to influence millions of kids who watch him and who look up to him as a role model. And he's just not. He's just not using that position and not using that advantage. And it's so frustrating and so annoying.
That was an all-time moment when the crowd was chanting Draymond sucks and he was like bouncing his head to it. Mm-hmm. That was an all-time heel move. But I agree 100%. My waste of data is from recurring waste of data, Skip Bayless. I really wanted to find something different, but Skip, you just... So hard to leave him out of this because his takes are so awful. Last night during the game, he said, now Kyrie is getting touched and embarrassed by Steph. And I don't know if he meant to say torched or touched, but either way, it kind of feeds into what I was saying earlier. It gets back to what I was saying earlier about how I don't think people were talking enough about how Kyrie was really battling through multiple injuries. And I don't think Steph had a good game, but I don't think the story that I saw a little bit today is like, two championships for the Warriors and Steph hasn't won an MVP at either of them. And like, I don't think he has shown me like stage, especially against Kyrie, to like definitely not to be superior to Kyrie and definitely like not, he wasn't that impressive, I thought, relative to the rest of his teammates, especially Kevin Durant. And it was a bad joke, maybe a typo mixed in there and I did not appreciate it.
Well, the best part is that I think what often goes unnoticed in that, like that little tiny individual matchup in which Kyrie has shown himself to be better than Steph, is that Kyrie actually has to play the other end of the court.
Yeah.
So on the other end of the court, he has to go against Clay, go against their best defender, and then guard Steph.
Yeah.
And Steph gets to hide himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was just, it was a stupid take, but it's what you expect. John, finish this up.
Right. So my waste of data this week is all the small takes for perpetuating the patriarchy.
What did you do this week? You need brownie points.
I don't know if you guys have noticed, but my sound quality has gotten better in the last 2 weeks, and that is due to a lovely gift from my dear fiance, who did not get a shout out last week, and probably should have had one.
This was a bribe.
But additionally, we went through this whole thing. Without talking about Elena Ostapenko, who has an amazing forehand and who won the French Open as a 20-year-old. She is the ultimate, baller in terms of tennis. She had over 50 unforced errors.
Is she a big baller?
Well, she probably doesn't buy the shoes. I don't think she's made enough money to buy the shoes because this is her first major title.
She's not a big baller.
Yeah, I know. But she had 50 unforced errors because her forehand is so strong it would fly out of the court, and she didn't stop using it, and she won. Like through sheer force of will and amazing framing of her shots, she won the French Open and in extraordinary style. And I'm excited because I think it means that when Serena comes back from her pregnancy and her maternity leave from the tour, that hopefully she's got someone who could really challenge her and push her consistently. And I look forward to those matchups in the future.
All right, then. That is our show for the week. Thank you guys for tuning in. Hit us up on those social media accounts and let us know, especially what you thought of that, the 3-on-3 mock draft 2020.1. Let us know which team you think is, which of us drafted best. Let us know your draft, your dream team. And let us know what you thought of the show in general. We appreciate your feedback. We appreciate you listening. Like we said earlier, next week will be a man down. Cooper and John will take it. And so you'll want to tune in to hear that sometime next week. Until then.
Dope.